everyone. Welcome back to the Faculty of Horror podcasting from the horrid halls of academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati. And it's September.
It's September. It's the new academic year.
Yay. Welcome back.
Do you get your new stationery bits?
Do you know, I actually experience acute anxiety and depression as soon as I start hearing the back to school ads on the radio. Because it's just like, oh, back to school, and next thing around the corner is Christmas, and it's all downhill from there. And you know how much it sucks to feel that way when I love Halloween, but my brain just goes right to Christmas?
And it also sucks when you tell your friend that over dinner a couple nights ago, and then she gets to sit with that.
I'm sorry. You know. I'm going to burden you all with it. All of you. Feel my pain.
Yeah, but until Andrea's depression fully crushes her, we are back. I think we're starting off this new semester with a really fun one.
I think so too.
So we're talking about the 1992 erotic thriller, Single White Female.
Yes, the film so iconic that it has a whole syndrome named after it.
Oh, we're going to get into that.
We're going to get into all of this. Look, I don't expect angry mail that this isn't a horror movie, but we get angry mail from all manner of things. This is horror adjacent. It's one of those thrillers.
I mean, the stiletto in the eyeball.
I don't know that I'd find it in the horror section.
No, but I wanted to do something fun.
Oh, yeah. No, it's fun. It definitely has a lot to chew on. You know, this film came out in 1992. There's been a ton of scholarship and think pieces, some of them great, some of them not so great over the years. But I think, you know, 2023, it's fun to look back on these films as an artifact of its time, which it very much is.
Yeah. And this was a film I saw kind of early in my teen, like, ooh, I think I really love film and I just want to watch all the films I can, is this like kind of tawdry curio to watch. So this is a film I've come back to time and again throughout my life. And each time I feel like I notice something different, parts of the narrative hit differently. And you know, the older I get, this is a film very much about young women starting out in their career, starting to get their footing, starting to figure out how they want to live. And you know, I am in a place right now where I frankly am fortunate enough, in my opinion, to live alone. I don't know if I could live with other people again. I am relatively lucky with the roommates I've had. I've had some wonderful roommates who are still some of my best friends to this day, but I've also had some terrible roommates. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, we're going to do a little personal sharing right now. In the first apartment I lived in with roommates when I was in Montreal doing my undergrad, one girl I didn't know, she and I became very close. And then I was living in the same apartment. There were also two guys. And one of the guys is still one of my very, very close friends from high school. And the other guy was like a year older than us in high school and also studying at the same university as us. And I think he kind of got us into the apartment. And that guy wound up having a really big crush on me. And it was so fucking awkward. It was like...
like he let it be known?
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
To the point where, like, our other, like, roommate was kind of like, can you just go out with him or something?
No.
Like, and I was like, no! And, like, this roommate would get kind of drunk and, like, knock on my door some nights and just be like, Alex, maybe we should just talk. And I'd be like, I'm covered in, like, zit cream and, like, my hair is a mess and I'm not doing this and I'm not interested. Eventually, he got a girlfriend, which was great, but then she never left the apartment.
Oh, one of those.
Yeah.
Did she look just like you? Did she start looking like you after getting to know you?
You know what?
Did
she get the same haircut? Well, she was, like, brunette, pale, but petite. Yeah.
We can't all get the tall drinks of water we want. Mm-mm. For myself, I have never lived alone.
Oh.
I have never lived alone. I have always had roommates or a partner and always one at a time. I've never lived with more than one roommate.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Which is interesting. I have two older sisters, but they both went away to school when I became a teenager. So I never really felt like I had the kind of full house experience of sisterhood and growing up with them and sharing clothes and the fights and the trips. So I felt like I was an only child growing up. And then I had a slew of roommates. I had some male roommates and I had some female roommates. And I got on better with the male roommates. And I think it was part of my 90s feminist trajectory of, oh, I'm one of the guys.
Yeah.
I don't like the things that girls like. I like, you know, playing video games and smoking dope and horror movies. And I just get on better with dudes. That sadly was the case. But yeah, I have definitely had more complicated relationships with female roommates because there's a lot more going on. And I think when I first saw this film, I don't have a very specific memory of it, but I think I was too young to really get all the gravity of the themes and what this film is saying, what this film is implying, what it means to be a young woman living with another young woman or a young man in the city, sharing a space to make rent, but so conventional, but it's not nuclear.
No. And it's during like the most intense period of your life. Again, that, you know, time where you're kind of carving out who you want to be, how you want to be that person. Mm-hmm. And you also have to navigate another person going through something similar and their partner and their wants. And do they have animals? And like, yeah. It all kind of, you know, there's so many like moments in this film, which are like, whoa, like they're real mic drop moments in so many ways. But the film is like a real breezy, like hour 40.
It is.
So you're like flying through stuff and you're like, whoa, what just happened?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I also feel like for the longest time, I looked at roommatehood or platonic shared accommodationhood as a rite of passage. Yeah. It's something that maybe you did as a student until you could afford to live on your own or until you were coupled up and you cohabitated. And so I always saw it that way. But of course, now being in my 40s, living in the big city, you got to make rent. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there are lots of very self-actualized, mature female friends of mine who have to share accommodations for that reason, and they make it work. And it's not just a teenage thing. It's not just an early 20s thing. It's a system of habitation. It's a thing.
Yeah. It's not just a stepping stone to something else. It's a real way to support and maintain a lifestyle without, you know, losing your mind and working all of the hours of the day.
That's right. Which I think factors in here.
Yeah. So let's respond to the ad. Let's make that phone call. Let's make the appointment. And this is Babette Schroeder's Single White Female from 1992.
In this city, on this street, in this apartment.
Hi, are you Allison Jones?
I'm Hedra Carlson.
Hedra, that's unusual.
When can you move in?
An ad for a roommate brought a stranger into Allison's life. Someone.
I look beautiful on you.
Who shares.
Well, it's kind of fun having a girlfriend again.
Someone.
Do you guys know when you'll be back?
No, it's kind of an anniversary tonight.
Really?
Who cares.
Where the hell have you been?
Making me feel like I'm 16 years old here.
Someone who borrows.
I've got a surprise for you.
You've got to be kidding.
I love myself like this.
It was like looking at myself. It was scary.
Someone who steals.
Hey, sleepy guy.
Ellie?
No, not Ellie.
Someone who would kill to be her.
Possible blood stains.
You gotta help me, Griff.
She's a lunatic, Ellie.
She needs me.
How do you lock the terror out?
Don't make me come get you!
When you already invited it in.
Look at me!
Bridget Fonda.
I know you weren't yourself when you did this thing.
Jennifer Jason Leigh.
I know. I was you.
Single white female. Living with a roommate can be murder.
Be careful, she's crazy.
When software developer Allie Jones breaks up with her fiancé Sam, she decides to find a roommate to share her Manhattan apartment. She settles on a girl named Hedra, and the two become fast friends. But Hedy shows a mean streak when Allie is sexually assaulted by a business client. Things get even more tense when Allie reconciles with Sam. Hedy becomes increasingly possessive of Allie and even starts dressing like her and adopting her identity at seedy nightclubs. When Allie discovers a newspaper clipping revealing that Hedy is actually named Ellen and that she once had a twin sister who drowned at the age of 9, she confides in her neighbor Graham, but Hedy overhears and attacks Graham later. In a desperate attempt to get Sam out of the picture, Hedy poses as Allie for a sexual encounter in his hotel room and tries to blackmail him. He refuses, and Hedy kills him via stiletto heel. iconic. Alex is making a face. I'm making a face. God, that scene's badass. By the time Allie puts it all together, Hetty has staged the whole scenario to pin a murder-suicide on her. Allie is able to kill Hetty with the help of a, surprise, not dead Graham, and she reflects in an epilogue that she must now grapple with survivor's guilt the way Hetty did.
That's the bare bones, but also, you know, because we can't talk in the synopsis about how Sam's, you know, tryst with his ex-wife is revealed through answering machine.
Loved it.
Oh my gosh.
It was so economical.
Yeah. And the kids these days, Andrea, they don't know.
They don't know.
They don't know. But like the anxiety over that, the montage of like other potential roommates, the Graham of it all. I want to talk more about him.
I want to talk more about Graham. I definitely want to talk more about the business client.
Yeah, fucking Mitch.
Because that comes full, like, it's the kind of thing that happens and you're like, oh, that's a shitty thing that happened to this young woman who's trying to be a professional in a professional setting that's male dominated. But then it all comes full circle and he comes back into the picture when you least expect him, not as a hero, but just as a player.
Yeah. And of course, the dog. I mean,
I didn't want to bring up Buddy.
No, we'll talk a bit about Buddy. But like, also, there's just a lot of like sex.
There's a lot of sex. There's gratuitous nudity that maybe has a function that I like or not so like.
There is a lot of stuff in this film. And it's Andrew, it's what you always talk about, standpoint theory. You know, depending on who you are, where you are in your life, you're going to look at all of these instances, all of these little pings in the narrative as meaningful, and you can interpret them in different ways. So as always, we're going to dive in and explore some of these things and some of these themes. And we are, of course, coming from it in our own standpoints and trying to share the information and knowledge we have. But of course, we are not almighty. We don't know everything. So
we aren't. We don't?
I mean, in this room we do, but...
Certain themes jumped right out at me. And I think in doing this research, there is a body of scholarship about this film. It tends to be focused on very specific things. And so I made an effort to make my notes kind of address other things. And then, you know, on the surface, it seems like a very conventional 90s thriller. But every so often, there would be a line where I'd be like, whoa, and I'd pause it and I'd write it down and be like, that was a fucking banger of a line. I want to pause the movie and gather my druthers and parse out what that means. And I have compiled some of those to throw at you a little bit later, because I don't think that they all necessarily translate into a big line of thought that's reflected in the film. Sometimes they're just banger lines. But how well do you know Barbet Schroeder?
I know he is a director of Iranian Swiss descent, but he came up in the French New Wave cinema and worked with a lot of the prominent filmmakers there in France. And then he moved over to Hollywood and kind of became, you know, a bit of a connoisseur maker of these like mid-budget Hollywood thrillers.
Now, I did find that, you know, this was his first true Hollywood studio production. It performed very well. And I heard a really interesting anecdote about his then unproduced film Barfly.
Oh, yeah.
Did you hear this one?
I don't know if I heard this one, but I know Barfly.
Apparently, Canon Films refused to surrender the rights to it. It hadn't been released yet. And so Schroeder charged into the president's office, brandishing a cordless electric saw and said, I don't have the time to go to a law firm, so my law firm is Black & Decker, and I'm going to cut off my little finger unless you respect your promise. Let history note that the film was made and released to much critical acclaim. So, you know, I read things like that, and I'm like, that's kind of badass.
Yeah.
And then I read that he's a Polanski supporter.
Yeah.
I mean...
But, you know, these films are problematic. We're going to talk about some of the problematic elements within it, and I think we should talk about the subgenre within which this film exists.
Okay. This is very much your territory.
I already love how you already knew just to give me like the runway for this.
Go.
So some of you out there may know, especially if you're subscribed to our Patreon, which you can do. It's always linked in our show notes. We do a lot of fun content over there. But I really during the pandemic, really delved into my interest in the erotic thriller. It started, you know, with films like Fatal Attraction and Basic Instinct, Hand That Rocks the Cradle, Single White Female, like all films that I'd seen before. But then there was this whole other subgenre that I really spent the pandemic watching as I was living alone and just, you know, going through separation and then eventual divorce. And that's films like American Gigolo, 9 1/2 Weeks, so many others that are about these very intense relationships. And there are a variety of relationships that have some element of sex to them, have some element of violence to them, some kind of intrigue. And they came about in the 80s. And they really kind of came from the puritanical political landscape that Reagan created, as well as the rising fear of AIDS and the stigmas against all of these, you know, minority communities within North America were amplified through these films. And another thing to consider when you're talking about erotic thrillers is that they are relatively inexpensive to make in comparison to, say, a big action film or a big sci-fi film. Mm-hmm. You're spending the money on actors and maybe some set pieces, but ultimately you can get some relatively big stars or really exciting up-and-comers and tell these really tawdry, kinky, sexy stories that offer glimpses into those worlds. But at the end, they always affirm heteronormativity, the family unit, something where you adhere to a patriarchal order to them. And what I always really enjoyed watching them, while you kind of have that critical lens, is just how truly fucking bananas they are. Mm-hmm. And each one kind of goes in a different direction. And it always gets into a place where you can be very like turned on by a really well done sex scene. But in the end, it's always like, well, that was bad and that was scary. And you should be scared of sex and being turned on. And like the mental gymnastics in these films is fascinating to me. And if you're interested in this subject, as I know I certainly am, the podcast, You Must Remember This, has just done two great seasons on the erotic 80s and the erotic 90s. We'll link those in the show notes. And then there's also a really good article on The Ringer called The Rise and Fall of the Erotic Thriller by Brian Rafferty. And that's, it's not too long, but it gives a really good general overview of a lot of those themes and topics. So it's a fascinating subgenre. Again, you know, started in the early 80s, rose to prominence with Fatal Attraction, and then kind of, you know, tails off by the mid 90s. Mm-hmm. But there are so many of them, and I am utterly fascinated by them. And then you still have like new ones that pop up every so often when they try to get revived. And I'm always like the first to watch it.
Yes, totally. What's that fucking Ben Affleck one that we watched?
Oh, Deep Water.
That one was such a throwback. You're right. It gets more complicated when you get out of the Reaganism era, because I do definitely feel like the 90s ones were, they offered a very safe escapism. We know you're tired of the nuclear family. We know that modernity is coming up and you're being presented with different options. And perhaps these options scare you. Perhaps they're a little kinky. Perhaps they're a little queer. But don't worry, the nuclear family unit is there.
Well, I always like to think of, when I think of subgenres, I like to think of who the studio imagines the audience to be. Uh-huh. Like, who is their demographic? And so I might be totally wrong in this, but when I watch these films, I'm like, these films are made for the couple who are married with a few kids. They hire a babysitter for the night and they go to see the kind of sexy movie that turns them on just a little bit.
Just a little bit.
But then affirms their entire lifestyle
choice.
So they
don't stray. Exactly.
So they don't stray, but they might go home and fuck.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They have that safe little thrill.
Yes.
In the darkened cinema. Mm-hmm. And they don't think about it again. I think that rings really true here. Did you get a sense that the ending seemed a little hasty?
So I've heard tell of an alternate ending, but I could not find anything official. Could you find anything?
No.
Okay.
I was really hoping you had. And of course, you know, I went to the conspiracy theory network, that is Reddit.
Ah, me too.
A theory that it had to do with Graham, and it had to do with the fact that he doesn't quite show his face in his big rescue. He's shown in the tub, where he could be dead, except that his cat is on him and his cat is not eating his face. And that's what cats do.
The cat heals him because the cat is a loving creature.
No, it does.
No, no. They lie on you and they heal you until that you can feed them again.
So when Graham comes back to life, we don't actually show his face. And that was tantalizing to me because it's like, without this male rescuer, without this white knight, what might have happened? But I could not find shit.
Yeah. So it's truly, that's about as far as I got as well. So it remains a mystery. I couldn't find anything.
If you know, listener, send it to us. I would love to hear.
If you're listening and you got a cut somewhere, send it to info@facultyofhorror.com.
I mean, I'm trying to think of an ending that I'd prefer.
I think given the subgenre and what it was setting out to do,
it's the only ending we could have
gotten. It's the only ending.
Although the epilogue is eerie. And we'll get to that. Yeah. We'll get to that. But first, let's kind of cover the bases that this film is based on the 1990 novel S.W.F. Seeks Same by John Lutz.
You cannot find this book.
Oh, you looked.
I looked. And also, the title was changed to Single White Female. And thank God, because Single White Female Seeks Same. I mean, that's not a great look.
None of this is a great look. I was actually thinking about that, single, white, and female. And are these three traits equally important in choosing a roommate? Now, when I was in my early 20s and I had roommates, it was always like, when you're in your early 20s, people are looking for somewhere to live.
Yeah.
You always know someone who's looking. And it wasn't until I was living in Toronto that I was in a position where I was willing to live with a stranger to keep my apartment. And it was that apartment on Queen and Bathurst,
yes.
Remember?
Yeah, yeah, on
that
Car
was
Street.
A fucking sick apartment.
It's a great apartment.
And I was old enough that I was like, okay, I just need a young professional who's here to hang their hat. Dustin was coming by a lot. I was also spending time in Oshawa a lot to see him. And, you know, we're older. Just like, if you can afford the rent, I will live with you. And so I did have the experience of posting on like Facebook Marketplace and on Craigslist. And I said that I was a female of a certain age, and this is what I did for a living, and this is what the unit was, and that was it. So there was nothing in my listing to say I needed you to be male or female because I truly didn't care. Yeah. I needed you to be white or otherwise because I truly didn't care. And so, yeah, I don't know. Single White Female Seeks Same to me kind of reeks of this really alarmist kind of, I want someone as similar as me as possible to live with the assumption that that will be most harmonious.
Well, and also the safest.
And the safest.
That's the assumption. And what's interesting is in the film, it changes in the ad to single white female seeks female.
Yeah.
So I think the film, for all of its problems, does soften that blow of seek same.
It does.
But I do think it's interesting that the film then complicates the request to, even though they inadvertently kind of do like, oh, she winds up with another single white female.
Mm-hmm.
It complicates it by turning that figure, the figure that is essentially should be very similar to her, should align with her, should be parallel to her, to Ali's wants and needs, and turns Hetty into this murderous, psychotic figure of terror.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes like this haunting, menacing figure that is always upon her, but has also provided her with great comfort.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, no, it's a hugely complicated and storied relationship that they have, but like, I cannot imagine stipulating race, stipulating single even.
I mean, it's interesting.
She's heartbroken, and maybe she doesn't want a man around and a man visiting and a man potentially cohabitating, but I also feel like single is so arbitrary.
It is tricky because, you know, your circumstances can change at any given point.
That's right.
But, you know, you maybe don't want someone else coming and going into the apartment. It can feel like a third roommate. Again, in my former situation, it was like this girl just fucking moved in.
Yeah.
And didn't pay rent and didn't wash the fucking dishes.
Yeah.
Which drove me fucking crazy.
Oh, I'm sure.
Slight side note to that from that time. I remember then sitting with my other female roommate, and she and I were really, really close. And we were sitting in the living room, and I'd come in from a class because I was doing my undergrad at the time. And it was just, the kitchen was just stacked with their dishes. And I went in and I sat in our living room with Caitlin, and she was just like sitting there. She was an English major, so she'd always had tons to read. And she was just sitting there, and I could see her like she was holding a book in front of her face.
Oh,
and
no.
But she wasn't reading. And she looked so tense. And I was like, hey, Kate, how's it going? And she's like, did you see the kitchen?
Ah.
And I was like, yeah, I had to walk through it. It's that's a lot. She's like, I'm not doing it, and you're not doing it either. So we're going to see who cracks first.
I remember a time in my life where roommate drama and fights over dishes and tidiness and boys coming over were like, they were my world.
Yeah.
They were like paramount in my stressor and my life. And so, you know, I do understand the desire to have control over that, but there's no control to be had in these identifiers, which
are... You can't. And I mean, the tricky thing is, like, roommates and shared accommodations, you know, came about really at the, you know, 19th century, really into the 20th century, and they really rose to prominence in urban centers as people from rural communities, as well as newcomers to any given country, were looking for access to work, access to money, and access to a certain kind of lifestyle. So the idea was you had a place, again, like you were saying, to hang your hat, to like put your shit, to sleep when you could, and you were kind of out and working and doing social things. So you expect to do a lot of things outside of the house. But I have found in my experience and career as a woman, getting into those situations can always be a bit tricky because there are concerns about safety. Yeah. There are you know, there's other things we always have to navigate, and we all do. We all do in our different ways. But it led me to think about this figure of the new woman. And the figure of the new woman emerged in the late 19th century, and it referred to women seeking radical change in their life, that they could be educated and career-minded, and that was cool. And it was really growing in prominence in the U.S. and Europe. And activities like bike riding were really central to the new woman because it allowed her an ease to get to new spaces and new communities, broadening her horizon. And the goal ultimately for this new woman was getting autonomy outside of men. Mm. So whether it be a husband, a fiance, a family member, anything like that. So creating a space for herself. And it was, of course, as you can probably all imagine, largely and predominantly confined to the upper classes of women, and particularly white women. You know, your single white female, the women who can afford to be single and white and female. Of course, because one of the things that I started to think about a lot when watching this movie and thinking about this movie was Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own, which is a very short book, and I recommend it if you haven't already checked it out. But it's a series of kind of essays and lectures that she gave, but it was published in 1929. And ultimately, Woolf's assertion is that in order for a woman to be able to create, to think, to process, to do all of these things that we want them and we desire to do, we need our own space. We need our own room, ideally with a lock and fucking key that no one else can access but us if we are wanting to write or create in any capacity. And in large part, this is a metaphor. You know, there is like the physical need for space, time, and all of that. But there are a lot of people who create and do incredible work without access to that.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
I guess I was
thinking
there's just
been a lot of criticism of it over the years.
Gotcha.
So, yeah.
I was thinking of all the male roommates who expected me to be their mom. And so when I think of a space of her own, it's just like not taking care of anybody.
Yes, no, exactly.
Oh, okay.
And that's really like, I think what Woolf gets at, and that's what I always take away from it. Like what happens when we allow a woman to be autonomous and not be in a caregiver role, whether it's to a partner, a child, animals, anything like that.
Yeah.
And you actually get to thoughtfully express and create.
And it's frustrating that that space is not conceptual space. It's not ideological space. It's not cultural space. It's literal space.
Yeah.
It's literal space and fucking financial hard numbers privilege.
Yeah. Super privileged.
Yeah.
Super privileged. And again, as someone who lives on my own, like, that is a true privilege.
Yeah. You can afford to be autonomous. That's fucked.
Uh-huh. And I think all of this kind of, as we talk and think about single white female, it goes into this anxiety about, you know, this film is based on a book written by a man, directed by a man, like the creatives behind it are men.
Uh-huh.
And to me, what I always take away is from this film, while it's entertaining and shocking and tawdry, it is about the anxiety of what women get up to when they are left on their own.
Yes.
Whether it's a woman on her own or women together on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And that we should be fearful of women together. And whether it's sexual or not sexual, whatever it is, there's always some kind of panic about it. And this is not new. This is not new to the 90s. It's not new to Reagan politics. It's not new to any of that. You can go back to the medieval era when single women who were on the outskirts of communities were labeled as witches.
Yeah.
And and murdered in large numbers because they would not conform to the new emerging religion of Christianity. And from there, you get this, you know, patriarchal Christian stigma around women existing on their own, gathering on their own, interacting with each other on their own. And it's in large part because you are not conforming to the role of a caregiver, a nurturer, and a childbearer.
Yeah.
And I think that's really where the fear and anxiety in single white female lies. And as we always talk about in these films, if you want to think about the politics of a horror film or any film, you know, think about, so in talking about horror and thrillers, where does the fear and anxiety lie?
Uh-huh.
It's about what women get up to behind closed doors, or what happens when two women are left on their own.
That's right. When one woman is trying to be autonomous, trying to rely on herself, and God forbid, rely on another woman.
Yeah.
Holy crap.
Because it's really fucked up because, like, yeah, okay, Hetty as a character in this film is like scary and a murderous monster.
Yes.
But man, this film really lets Sam off the hook. Like, man, he just like fucked his ex-wife. And the ex-wife is calling, like, damn.
Even a divorced cheating man is better than none, Alex.
That's kind of the message. And the thing that, like, it just, I don't know, maybe this isn't one of your quotes later on, but like the one of the opening scenes when Sam and Allie are in bed and they're talking about children.
So how many kids do we want?
I don't know. What's the statistical norm?
You and your statistics. 1.2.
Okay, then I want 2.2. And I want them to look like you.
It's poor kids.
And when Allie is asking about, like, what's the norm for the amount of children to have, and it's like, oh, you're just like, you just want the normal and you want them to look like him. You want this, you want this, you want this idealized, stigmatized version of whatever this life you're envisioning for yourself is.
I didn't clock that. I think I might have repressed it. Sometimes when people bring up children, I just tune out.
Can I show you the face I made when she's like, oh, what's the normal amount?
Yeah, show me the face. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how to express
that. And then you held
that
up this?
Yeah.
This is the normal amount.
I don't know how to express that face in an audio format.
I don't know.
Wait, what does this face look like?
Whatever our listeners are picturing is probably apt.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave it to them.
Deep concern and disgust.
It's sort of a cringe, but more of a wince.
Yeah. Because, like, kids are cool. If you want to have kids, have all the kids you want. But, my God.
If your goals in life are the national average.
Yeah.
You might, aim high.
Yeah, maybe just try to get a room for yourself on your own for like a day. See if that changes things.
So Sam does get off the hook, but he also gets fucking raped in this film.
Let's talk about that.
You know, and it's. I will hold this film accountable on a 2023 rewatch. I'm going to poke holes in it. Yeah. We're going to talk about it. At the time, it was not possible in the wide psyche that men could be raped, mm-hmm. especially if they were the penetrative force. For men to penetrate, they have all the power. There's so much arousal and power inherent in being a penetrative force. And so this whole scene where, you know, Hetty is flating him under the guise of being Allie, and he still comes, he still ejaculates. I definitely watch that scene differently now than I did 30 years ago.
Absolutely,
I will tell you that much. The whole idea was that Hetty was forcing Sam to cheat to prove that he can't be trusted, but she raped him. And you don't accuse rape victims of being unfaithful. That's ridiculous. You know, our society needs to acknowledge that men can be raped, that they are raped, that their assaults are even more underrepresented due to society's views of victimhood. It's understudied, it's underrepresented, and there's so much in with that. And like nowadays, we've expanded the definition of rape to include all of the boundaries and details of a sexual encounter. If you agreed on condoms and someone takes one off without you knowing, that's rape. And that extends to what happens to Sam.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a moment that I hadn't seen this movie in a number of years, and I'd completely forgotten about that. Because I always remember the stiletto to the eye, but I never remember
the stiletto to the eye is rather
Sam's
distracting.
Rape.
Sam's rape and the fact
which is
that
real.
Sam had everyone bought into this whole idea of now you're fucked. There was never any question of, well, I'll tell Allie the truth and she'll believe me. And that is tragic. And it wouldn't have occurred to me as tragic 30 years ago. So let's just put that out there.
Yeah. No, I mean, the relationships in this film are fraught. They're sexualized. They're complicated. It's a real fucking minefield.
Rape is about control, dominance, and objectification. And that's like, that's what Sam is. You know, he's just kind of this marionette on these strings. And, you know, I didn't get a chance to read the book. I was so glad that you mentioned that it was unavailable, because that kind of gets me off the hook there. But from what I understand, is the book is mostly about women sparring for social status and kind of using, like, men kind of fall in their wake.
Right.
You know, they're kind of just collateral damage in what is fundamentally female anxiety, female hysteria, females trying to make it in the big city. And I do think that that rings true. I think Sam is, you know, he does have sort of a redemption arc, but he does have a tragic end.
Yeah. I mean, hey, listen, all these things can be true. You can be a cheater. Yeah. You can want to make amends. You can mean to make amends. And you can also be a victim.
Can forgive a cheater. And that's just fine.
Yeah.
People can change. Yeah.
So, Andrea, I would love to throw you a question.
Do it.
Describe the character of Allie to me.
Allie is a stylish, beautiful, smart go-getter. She is a software developer, which it's still a very male industry, yeah. But at that time it was probably largely non-existent. She is self-employed. She's got this apartment in Manhattan. She's going places. At least she's going to die trying.
I think that's all fair. She definitely, when I think about Allie as a character, it's like she's a character that is undefined yet full of promise.
Okay.
Which feels very much like a pretty typical Hollywood heroine.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to give her too much detail because you don't want to make her inaccessible.
No, we don't have much backstory.
She has no interests, no quirks.
She's lonely.
Uh-huh.
She's lonely and lost. She's a little girl doe-eyed in a big city, blink, blink.
Because one of the things when I really started to think about who Allie is, because in thinking about Allie, you have to think about what Hedy is trying to copy.
Yes.
And so much of it is surface. It's the haircut. And I don't know if you came up with this in your research, but the kind of auburn bob that Bridget Fonda had, that Jennifer Jason Leigh has later in the film, became one of the most copied hairstyles in America in 1992.
That's very interesting.
Isn't it?
Well, it makes me think of Rosemary's Baby.
Exactly. A New York City apartment, very desirable, but it's maybe too good to be true.
A boyish, androgynous haircut that maybe the boyfriend doesn't so much like, but they're like, whatever, this is haute couture. This is what the women are wearing now.
Listen, from what I understand, living in NYC is very complicated and tricky. But one of the things that occurred to me in this rewatch was that Allie is predominantly surrounded by men as we come to know her. First, there's Sam.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's Graham, her upstairs neighbor, mm-hmm. her gay BFF.
Yeah.
And then there's Mitch, the client.
Right.
We learn about Allie through these men and the way they treat her and the way she reacts to them until Hedy shows up. You know, her talk about kids with Sam. So we know what her goal is. She wants to be with Sam. She loves him. That's great. And like, she would love to have kids with him. She wants to solidify that relationship,
mm-hmm.
not just through marriage, because Sam is already divorced, but through children.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is me projecting a little bit, but you know, you're listening. We're all going
with
it.
I'm into it.
She's uncomfortable with these other quote unquote odd roommates who come to interview for the apartment before mm-hmm. she meets Hedy. Mm-hmm.
Are you going to buy this time, or are you just curious?
I suppose I'm bi-curious.
There is a mention of a previous partnership with a woman.
Yes.
And it is when she's talking to Mitch, and he's like, I did some digging, and I know about your partnership, and I know you walked away with, you know, the software and this rent-controlled apartment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, also, how do you walk away from like a business partnership with a rent controlled apartment?
That doesn't make sense.
I don't know. But, you know, 1992, New York City, anything goes, I guess. But it's this like implication of this female relationship that was very close, that, you know, revolved around developing software that ended acrimoniously. And we have to take Allie's word on that.
Yeah.
And, you know, she is our protagonist. She's our, you know, essentially narrator. Like, we see everything through her eyes. So why wouldn't we trust her?
Yeah.
And I don't think there's any reason not to, but I think it's such an interesting thing. We never see her with another woman except Hetty.
Okay.
And that this apartment is used against her by Mitch. He's like, I can fucking pay you less because I know what you pay for that apartment.
Yes.
And so this thing that she fought for, that she got out of this acrimonious fallout, is used against her.
Yeah.
I can fucking shortchange you. I can minimize you. I can do whatever I want to you because I know what you fucking pay.
Yeah.
And that is so demeaning. It is so icky. It is so gross. And what I took away from it was that if she wants to stay in this world of like software design and you know, her career and where she wants to go to achieve some sort of autonomy, she will eventually have to submit to a man, whether it is through marriage and bearing children or through taking what creeps like Mitch are willing to dole out to her.
Welcome to adult life, Allie. I did kind of clock that there was the implication that a partnership with a fellow female ended acrimoniously, and that, and this is a very 90s vibe, is that women can't get along.
Yeah.
They cannot. And that's fundamentally what this film underlines in the very end, doesn't it?
Yeah. And like, I mean, as speaking as someone who has a deep creative partnership with another woman, it's like, I don't know if I trust anyone else to do this with. So it's interesting. Like, we are fed this kind of diatribe about women and how we do or we don't get along. And
it's essentializing. I have had female roommates that I've gotten along with and female roommates that I haven't. I don't know why we are so quick to jump to all women are like this. And women who can't get along with other women better learn to play the men's game.
Yeah. As I thought about Allie and like as this heroine in this film, I just got very sad because in so many ways, as I wrote these notes, as I thought about it, as I kind of like ticked off all the things I could learn about her, her life just kind of got smaller and smaller.
Oh, yeah.
It's just really complicated. And the film, for all that it wants to examine, is not willing to examine that.
Yeah.
And that's why it's a product of its time.
Yeah. I hadn't given a whole lot of thought to Allie. Like, she seemed to have it together, but she was struggling. But I never worried about her.
But she's a cipher. And that's the point. Is she's supposed to be kind of malleable and undefined enough that we all project ourselves onto her. But in creating characters like that, it encourages us as women to be ill-defined in our own boundaries.
Right.
And what we accept and what we want and where we're willing to be direct or aggressive or however we want to be labeled.
Yes.
So we're always meant to be pliable.
There's that, but then there's also the fact that she is undeniably attractive. She is undeniably stylish. Yes. And we can't deny that that is currency.
Completely. Pretty privilege is a real fucking thing.
Pretty privilege probably got her Mitch's attention to begin with, not to mention Sam. And it's what seduced Hetty.
Yeah. She is an attractive, well-spoken, put together, you know, Bob wearing young woman.
Yeah. Even though she has very little, she is able to project this cultural currency that makes her seem like she has it all.
And that proximity to power is both kind of like a blessing and a curse. Like, we see how far it gets her, but like, her boyfriend cheats on her.
Yeah.
The client is a fucking rapist creep.
Yeah. Silly pretty girl, you can't have it all. Now, let's talk some more about Hetty. Her name is Ellen, but she goes by Hedra. Hedra is the plural of hedron, which is a polygon with many sides. It can be an octahedron that has 8 sides, or a decahedron that has 10 sides. It's a many-sided figure. We get it. She's got 2 faces. Holy shit. Subtle.
I mean, listen, it was 1992. You got like an hour 40. You got to bang out all the metaphors you can.
Sure.
And I think Hetty has become an iconic character in large part because Jennifer Jason Leigh is an incredible actor.
Oh, yeah. And this was such a departure from, you know, the Brat Pack stuff.
Yes.
She's willing to play a monster. She, single white females, Hetty has become a monster. It has become a specter.
Truly. And it's like so much of this film, like in the hands of another actor, could have been truly embarrassing and awkward. But I'm like, no, I believe it. She sells every goddamn moment she's on screen.
She's oddly sympathetic.
Completely. Like, you're so invested. And Bridget Fonda is really great too as Allie. So you're really invested in both of them. And this film truly benefits from having really talented actors leading it.
I agree. And their chemistry, like when they're friends, you feel it and you're happy for them.
It's like, have you ever seen 9 1/2 Weeks?
No. That's a very racy erotic thriller, isn't it?
I mean, it's kind of like perceived as the most, it's perceived as the most racy, and I wouldn't necessarily argue with that, but it's a really interesting film because the first like 30 minutes of it, it's like a youngish woman, Kim Basinger, maybe her 30s, divorced and just like meets this super hot guy and just has all of the sex.
But it's Mickey Rourke.
It's young Mickey Rourke.
I know. I think I'm just not attracted to Mickey Rourke enough.
Okay. This is where I say, I get it, but you haven't seen 9½ Weeks with young Mickey Rourke.
That might
like, because everyone's
things.
Like, oh, Michael Douglas. But I'm like, yes, Mickey Rourke.
Okay.
Like young Mickey Rourke. Oh, boy. And so like there's this first half hour of the movie where they're just having like kinky, fun, fucking sex. And you're like, fuck yes, get it.
Like how kinky? Like doggy style?
No, like like there's like
toys.
There's toys. There's food play.
Oh,
there's
shit.
All
okay.
kinds
all
of right. like shit happening, and they really go for it in a really in a few instances. And then it's like then it goes too far,
of course.
And then it's like dark and upsetting. And it is based on a woman's memoir where it sounds actually quite upsetting. But this film like truncates it so it becomes this like 30 minutes of like hot, consensual, interesting sex. To like, she's this tortured person in this horrible relationship.
Right.
And we are deprived of women experiencing pleasurable, sex positive relationships in their life.
Okay.
And it sucks. I wish we had more of it. Anyway, but Hetty falls into this interesting character space of being unstable that turns deadly. And we see this in other characters, other female characters from like Fatal Attraction and Hand That Rocks the Cradle. And in many recent pieces of writing about the film, much has been made of Hetty's queer coding.
Yes.
So,
and by much, I mean the majority.
The majority. Yeah. The vast majority.
Uh-huh. And I get it.
Oh, totally. And I think for, you know, us as straight women, you know, we are coming to it from, we have a lot of close female friendships and like, I don't like that this film problematizes close female relationships, but I think we would be doing a disservice in this episode if we didn't bring in some of the queer conversation. So
I agree. And the sexuality, you know, even though I will say that this film pussyfoots around it.
Yep.
Just the gratuitous nudity of Hetty, the many, many nipple bum shots, the very, like, it, there is not a whole lot of overt homosexuality, but the gaze is very pervy.
Yeah. And that's an interesting point because I was watching this. It's on the Criterion channel, which is, you know, Criterion. They release all those special editions and they also have a streaming service that I subscribe to. And they've got a series on there called Queer Sighted. And I watched the edition of it that's called Queer Sighted, The Gay Best Friend. And it's a discussion between Michael Koreski and Mark Harris. And it talks about, again, the gay best friend in cinema from its earliest days to very, very recently and how it has evolved, why it's problematic. And both Koreski and Harris raise a lot of interesting points, particularly around, obviously, Graham and Hetty. So Graham, who is Allie's upstairs neighbor, played by Peter Friedman, who is also Frank on Succession for any other Frank heads.
Are there Frank heads?
Yeah. Fuck yeah, Frank. It was very funny to like watch this film again and be like, oh my God, it's Frank. And like young, hot Frank at that. But Graham is this like non-threatening, desexualized, defanged, perpetually there for Allie gay. He is the gay that like, you know, you think gay people are if you've never met one. Like one of my best friends is gay.
Yeah.
He does not talk to me the way Graham talks to Allie.
No, he's so much more than just this super safe dude who's looking out for you, but has no sexual intentions and is there for sale. I love defanged. That's fucking hilarious.
But then they also talk a lot about the dark sexuality of Hetty and that kind of, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that, you know, when Hetty kind of will take off her top or like do something in front of Allie. And they talk a lot about how those moments are really interesting because a moment that could just be simple and easy, just someone feeling comfortable with their body is immediately problematized. Mm. Not because of Hetty, but because of Allie's reaction to it.
That's right.
Because the camera closes in to show Allie feeling uncomfortable and looking away. It's not just like, oh, she's obviously comfortable with her body and this isn't a big deal because we all have bodies and they're all fine and they're all doing their thing.
Yeah.
I was actually reminded by one of our friends who I used to live with.
Yeah.
she and I lived together for like 7 years, and she'd be like, I want to see your boobs. And I'd be like, no, you can't see my boobs. And we were just like, we're still to this day, like, she's one of the dearest, closest people in my life. And she reminded me recently, she was like, you know what? I did fucking see your boobs. Oh. I was like, when? And she was like, you flashed me in the bathroom of Grumpy's, which was a bar in Montreal.
Okay.
And she was like, I remember them. They were great. And I was like, oh, thank you.
It's so context dependent, because insofar as I mentioned earlier in this episode that I felt like an only child, there was a time where there were two teenage women. I was very young, living in this, you know, 3-bedroom house. And it was, you did not lock the door if you were peeing, because you did not dare monopolize the room with two teenagers in the house. And so seeing each other in various states of undress was totally normal, totally non-sexual. And then later in my life, when I started playing roller derby, changing in front of each other, touching each other, showering in front of each other is very normalized.
Yes.
And so, yeah, like, I haven't seen your tits. I don't think I'd be too weirded out about it, but I've definitely seen Ashley's.
But I mean, we've traveled together so many times, yeah. And like, we always kind of like scurry away to the bathroom to change. And it's, but it's, you know, like, there's so much internalized anxiety about that.
It's such a subtle thing. Like, yeah. I think if I had eye contact with you and I just took off my shirt and bra, that would be weird for both of us.
But like, it's also, has the patriarchy made it weird?
Well, this film has a gaze.
Honestly, can that be a t-shirt? Has the patriarchy made it weird for us?
Has the patriarchy made it weird?
But like, I think, you know, in this series, I think they just brought up some really great points.
And I think so too. I think that's brilliant.
They also talked about how Allie's desire to have that female roommate is meant to be safe, and that it is eventually co-opted through the film, and that in single white female, the queer interloper, not the gay who stays in his apartment, is incorrect, inappropriate, and murderous. Graham, on the other hand, is meant to be the quote-unquote good gay. He is not overtly sexual. He mentions that he's single. It's to reduce AIDS panic. Mm-hmm. And he is excessively interested in supporting Allie. That is his primary function.
Yeah.
Graham has no interior life, and therefore it kind of cheapens his inclusion within the film.
Yeah.
Anyway, Queer Sighted, it's on Criterion Channel. If you don't subscribe to it already, I think they do like a 7-day free trial. Watch it. An interesting conversation. The whole series is fantastic.
It is a really fascinating trope that has emerged. The gay BFF just totally living for you. Like, telling you that you're pretty, hating your
ex. I always think of like Rupert Everett and My Best Friend's Wedding.
Totally. Totally. Like, it abounds. I'm sure there's examples that I'm not even thinking of, but it is so reductive, and it is, I can't get over defanged. I just can't.
Yeah. Because like, all the queer people I know are like,
have their own lives.
Yeah. And they're always like, you're doing what? You did that. That's fun. Yeah. I've done 10 million times more of that in the last week. You weird fucking normie.
They may be a bit more comfortable than my cis hetero guy friends to tell me that I look hot, or that I don't look hot, or that my eyebrows are whack one day, and there is value in that. You know, this film essentially puts lesbophobia and homophobia, like, stereotypical, even when it's nuanced.
Yes.
You know, it's worth mentioning that the potential roommates that come in are all lesbian stereotypes. The leather-clad butch, the neurotic second-wave feminist who hates domesticity, the sultry, flirty femme. And then we've got Hetty coming in with this feminine compassion at seeing,
who can also fix the taps.
She can also fix the taps, but like, silly and giggling. And we're just girls in a men's world. We're all in this together. Tee hee.
Yeah. So while we kind of talk about Hetty and the queer phobia that exists within single white female, I had been thinking a lot about the doubling that happens within the film.
Yes.
And I happened to find a really good article. We will, of course, link this in the show notes. And it's called Revolting Doubles, Radical Narcissism and the Trope of the Lesbian Double by Olu Genzu in the Journal of Lesbian Studies. And it's a really interesting article. So highly encourage you, if you're interested, to check out the whole thing.
Show notes.
But to summarize, that these doubles that are present in many films are homophobic representations that are infantilizing, psychotic, and sterile. They basically ape on a lot of the anxieties that people have around leaving a heteronormative, quote unquote, stable relationship. They are marked as being antisocial. Mm-hmm. And that is the worst thing you can be in a patriarchal, heteronormative society, going back to the women who lived on the outskirts of communities in medieval times. They also mentioned that Barbara Creed noted this trend of lookalikes in lesbian couples in both fashion photography and pornography, and that it was, you know, a big part of a kind of male fantasy.
Yes.
To see two women,
twins,
very similar, but that in that expression of this kind of sexuality, it was for very limited times, either a photo or a relatively brief pornographic film, because who's watching all of them? But, you know, for those, you know, marked periods of time. And then they also reference the other films that contain it on top of Single White Female, films like Basic Instinct, Mulholland Drive, and Black Swan.
Yes.
There is this kind of anxiety about the movement from this male fantasy into a wider heteronormative sphere, that going from this one thing you could kind of jerk off to, and when it gets into a more like, again, this heteronormative couple I posited would go see a film like this, they can get off on the titillation of it, but to go anywhere further with it is to court madness. And it is this, essentially, it kind of gets back to that male panic about what women do when they're on their own.
Yes.
And that this, you know, fear of like what we talk about on our own, or what we get up to, what we plot, what we do, it's all in service of ourselves and not of them.
Right. And I feel like there's echoes of that to this day, where I feel like there are things that are relegated to your hetero female relationships. You talk to other girls about feelings. Females are there for you in a certain respect, but they can't really replace all of that, right? And certainly Hetty, insofar as she understands what Ali is going through, especially with regard to her client, the fact that she's like, you know what? We can hit him where it hurts. Let's call him at his house and threaten him.
No, Ali, don't turn this around. You're the victim.
You should pay for this.
He'll pay. He set up all my programs so they have to eventually.
What? I'm not talking about getting paid. I'm talking about getting even.
That is something that I don't think Sam would have done for her. That is something that's just kind of like, hey, we need to get back at him.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, we talk about this anxiety about like, oh no, that's scary and weird. But I was like, God, that's so badass.
Yeah.
And it was actually very similar to a conversation I had with two very good friends of mine who are both former roommates of mine as well, like this past weekend, where we were all sitting around talking about how we've gone through breakups and, you know, various other things. We've always been like, okay, let's be cool. Let's, you know, do whatever. And then we're always like, as a friend, you just advocate for your friend.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, I don't care. I don't have that fucking attachment. I will fuck that other person up on your
exactly.
behalf.
Exactly. I am team you yeah. all the way.
Yeah.
And that loyalty is Ooh. Not to be expected from something that is relegated to the wank bank.
But here in this film, it's kind of, you know, in the moment, maybe it's empowering, but the larger narrative posits it as a part of psychosis.
Yes.
And so it's like, oh, don't, you know, be wary of people who are too on your side, yes. you know, and that's it. This is how the film becomes problematic.
That's right. This is exactly where it becomes problematic, is in the idea that heterosexuality is not only deviant, but ill and I think, traumatized.
Exactly. And the interesting thing is, when I feel like in the film, when I see Ali truly happy, it's when she's with Hetty and Buddy the dog, and like they're laughing again. It's like little montages, but she's happy. She's enjoying her life. She's mm-hmm. not necessarily worried about Sam or the anxiety that comes with that. She is living her life, whether through just a platonic friendship or through something more that she's yet to explore. And it's just cool. Mm-hmm. And then the film takes that. It's like that point in 9.5 weeks when it just like turns.
It can't last.
You can't be that happy. You can't be that self-satisfied.
Not without a man. Yeah. I mean, let's talk about the psychology in the film. Let's talk about the weak swings at armchair psychology that this film takes. And like the 90s psychological thrillers are filthy for this. You know, there was a trend of obsession and stalking in the 90s. Cape Fear, Misery, I Know What You Did Last Summer, The Crush, The Cable Guy. These movies don't try very hard to explain the mania. They're just crazy, and crazy is scary. And that's, I couldn't help but notice, but that was in contrast to, say, Psycho, which we did an episode on, where they do take pains to explain, like, in this psychobabble that's very dated and very Freudian, and we problematized it when we talked about it. But at least they did try to give the audience something to hold on to, which makes it a little bit scarier, I think.
Yeah.
And what this film does is it hangs everything on survivor's guilt. Mm. And that's something that's really driven home in the epilogue toward the end, where Ali says she never forgave herself for surviving. I need to ask you, first of all, Alex, do we all unanimously believe that Hedy didn't kill her sister?
I mean, I thought she did.
I thought she did too. And like, having seen so many of these movies, having witnessed this trope washed, rinsed, and repeated so many times, I felt like that was inexorably going to be a reveal.
Yeah.
And the fact that it wasn't remains a question mark to me, because I'm not sure if I want it to be true or if I don't want it to be true, but I feel like the film is taking it at face value that no, she wasn't a murderess. She wasn't born crazy. She was made crazy by this tragic accident and this survivor's guilt. Now, survivor's guilt in the film, you know, I think Sam refers to hypervigilant, a state of heightened sensitivity to one's environment. Everything that they're talking about in this film points to PTSD, and like a more modern read of what's going on points to borderline personality disorder, the intense fear of abandonment, willing to go to extreme measures to avoid real or imagined rejection, rapid changes in self-identity, all of that stuff. And then we've got this epilogue that strongly implies that Ali might share Hedy's fate, having survived that ordeal. So I feel like it, not only is there the imminent danger that Hedy poses and that, you know, she might kill Ali and everyone around her, but that the trauma of that is so dangerous in and of itself that you're just going to become Hedy and perpetuate it all.
Well, exactly. And that by kind of letting this figure into your life, you essentially become damaged goods.
It's so fucked up. And yet, when we talk about single white female syndrome, and this is something that I had a lot of fun Googling, because, you know, like, I wanted to get into the psychobabble. I wanted to get into like how we are revisiting this film so many years later. And when you hear single white female syndrome used in popular culture and in all these blogs that I looked at, they don't refer to borderline personality disorder. They don't even refer to PTSD. They refer to the mimicry. They refer to a very specific aspect of the film that Hedy started imitating Ali. And in fact, this kind of mirroring is super common, and especially in younger women. I can actually think of several female friends who've struggled with something similar, either in their teenage years or even more recently, that they have a friend who was getting a little bit too close, was getting a little bit too needy, kind of co-opting their friends on Facebook, who was kind of adopting their identity and expanding it in problematic ways. And so this is a thing. This is a thing with women, and there's a lot more to it than this, you know, 90s movie that we all relate it to. And that got me thinking about teenage identity formation. And particularly when I was rewatching the film, the opening sequence of the two little girls who are virtually identical, and they're helping each other out with their beauty rituals. We brush each other's hair, we apply this lipstick. And I recalled that when I was in elementary school, I had a BFF, and we totally went through a phase where we dressed the same.
Oh, yeah?
Did you not have this?
No.
Admittedly, it was late 80s, and it was the late 80s uniform of bike shorts and a hypercolor shirt. But if one of us had a hypercolor shirt, the other had to have a hypercolor shirt. And it was that way with so many teen fads at the time. We were like a unit. And then later, like when you're a teenager, you're experimenting with the soft clay of your identity. You're trying things out. And the things you wear and the social cues you put out through your outfit, through your look or your hair or your makeup become a really big deal.
Yeah, your vibe attracts your tribe.
It really does. And, you know, for me, when I was in high school, I had a dress code.
Oh, yes.
And so that was kind of really narrowed down to these little pinprick items of your shoes, your hair, and your jewelry became a really big deal because everything else you were wearing were exactly the same. And the reason for that, which we alluded to earlier in the episode, and we've talked about many times before, is that for women, beauty is power in this society. And because beauty norms are socially constructed and always being renegotiated, the only way to learn beauty is through observation and, to a certain extent, imitation. So psychologically, there is something called mirroring as it appears in teenage girls, where you're not sure how to dress, but your friend seems to look good, and so you dress like them. And this has the dual benefit of reassuring both you and your friend that this is the way to dress. This is to be a girl. This is to be a woman. When you're very insecure, there's so much affirmation and approval in dressing the same. And of course, I couldn't help but think of how so many of my female bisexual friends have talked about part of their awakening to bisexuality was parsing out the difference between she's hot, I find her hot, I'm attracted to her and the vibe that she's putting out, but there's that line between, do I need to try that haircut or do I want her to sit on my face? And that is something that is so complicated and so confusing. And I tried to do more research on it, and it was all just leading me to Reddit and testimonials. And so I'm not sure to what extent this is being studied. But sexual identity is, it's not just how you see yourself. It's also how you want to be seen by others. And so it's a really complicated, murky thing that this film scratches on the surface of.
Yeah. It's such a complicated thing because I think especially like we are such a visual society. And when you see someone you're attracted to and you, or you become attracted to a person, there are parts of them you want to emulate, whether it's something physical or your phrasing or, you know, we are always constantly trying to ingratiate ourselves to other people. And it's such a tricky thing to navigate because I think when someone's attracted to you, they should be attracted to you as a person and like all of your quirks and foibles and all of that good stuff. Mm-hmm. But I always thought like a lot of the mimicry in this film and like kind of the queer fear that happens around it is that in this, you know, pseudo relationship that Hetty and Allie have, it's that between them, they will never biologically produce a child.
Yes.
So they reproduce each other.
Mm.
And of course, you know, that's not to say any, you know, gay couple can't adopt and have kids and have in vitro fertilization, all that kind of stuff. Like that's all very much part of medicine right now, as it should be. But like this kind of like, oh, well, they can't have the norm family that Allie talks about at the beginning of the film.
Right.
But she can have this like demonic daughter who is also in love with her.
Right. Or this demonic twin. It's an artificial limitation.
Yeah. But actually, it's funny. I'm realizing right now the tank top I'm wearing.
Yeah.
Is inspired by something I saw our friend Joanne wear.
Interesting.
Yeah, she was wearing a cut of this, and I just thought, that looks so great on her.
Yeah.
And I went and found something similar, and now I'm wearing it.
And it, like, yeah, it is kind of a journey where you're like, when somebody is very, is an individual and is very stylish.
I mean, you could have complimented me, but, you know.
Impressive. It looks great on you.
Thank you.
I've never seen that top. And Joanne.
Thank you.
I'm sure it looks great on her, too.
It looks great on both of us. We're basically the same person.
But I've been there. I've been there where like there's the attraction that's like, I would like to adopt that. But then there's the attraction to the power, the heteronormative, stylish power of the beautiful woman who has, you know, and you perceive that she has, you know, all these men on marionette strings and she has the world in the palm of her hand. It's an illusion, but it's a tantalizing illusion.
And it's hard because like, is it an illusion? Again, and we've talked about this, like our society is so predicated on our visualization of each other.
It's real in its consequences.
It's a snake eating itself.
Yes, it is.
Anyway.
I want to talk real estate.
Oh, yeah.
It is hard to ignore.
Yeah, the thing I will never have.
The thing that we will never have.
Yeah.
But also the thing that is so omnipresent in this film. So many establishing shots of this stunning exterior, this elaborate... I don't even have the architectural vernacular to describe it, but
they embiggened.
Embiggened, sure. They are inhabiting the Ansonia. This whole film takes place in the Ansonia condominium, which was formerly the Ansonia Hotel. And it is a New York City designated landmark. It's registered in the National Register of Historic Places. And this place has a fucking Wikipedia entry that is a mile long. It has a huge history, a place of great opulence that fell into disrepair in the 70s, and the owners were going to tear it down, but a successful grassroots neighborhood petition saved it. And like, people are living here and they need to afford to be able to live here, and so you need to keep the rents down. But at the same time, the building was crumbling, and so in keeping the rents down, the landlords couldn't afford to keep it up. And so you have these girls inhabiting not only an archaic social system that doesn't acknowledge the fact that women can be there for each other and be okay in whatever relationship they choose, but like they are in a crumbling building,
yeah.
A building that is literally crumbling underneath their feet. And it got me thinking about rent control.
Mm.
And this is something that comes up. You know, we live in Toronto.
Yeah.
Rents are astronomical. Yeah. Alex was alluding earlier to, I have given up the dream of owning property in Toronto. It is not going to happen.
Yeah, I'm waiting for my parents to die to take
their
place.
There was a while that it's like, oh, the bubble might burst and buyer's markets and renter's markets.
You almost bought a place.
I almost did.
At one point in our lives.
There was a shade of a possibility of a one-bedroom condo 8 years ago. That is long gone. That is just like, it's just not a reality. And I kept reading up on rent control that it was controversial.
Mm.
And I'm like, rent control is controversial? How is it controversial? So here are the arguments against rent control. It reduces the supply of decent housing, as landlords would rather convert a building to condos or commercial properties to be able to charge more rent. There's less investment in new housing, and there's low motivation for landlords to make repairs. And I was like, okay, those are the arguments against rent control. The arguments for rental rates rising higher than wages rising.
Mm-hmm.
Low and moderate income people can live in peace without worrying about homelessness every fucking year.
Yeah.
How is this controversial? On what fucking planet?
Do you want to bang the table? I feel like you might feel better if
you bang
the table. A little
bit. I'm trying not to because we're podcasting, but I was just kind of like, rent control was always one of those things that I was like, it's controversial because I don't understand it. There's more nuance. There is no more nuance.
No.
People want to be able to live and afford rent outside of a capitalistic structure where landlords just want to make as much money on their investment as they can. And that's 100% the case.
And I mean, like, I will be totally transparent. Like, I am in my now beautiful apartment because of a friend who got me into that space. And the landlords were cool to not raise the rent. So I'm paying way below market.
Yeah.
And the landlords are very nice. The place is in good keep. So I don't need repairs. I think I needed one thing fixed when I moved in. And they did it right away, and they don't raise the rent yearly.
Yeah.
They're just like, just keep paying on time. We're good.
Meanwhile,
and that's the biggest rarity in Toronto.
Meanwhile,
and it's sickening.
I live in a totally bougie 3-bedroom, beautiful historical house in a neighborhood I could never afford to live if Rue Morgue wasn't paying for half of it.
Yeah.
And this is the reality. And so I feel like this backdrop really paints such a great picture of this whole scenario that these are young women trying to make it in the big city and they have to fight for the luxury to live in a castle that's literally crumbling around them.
And again, I mentioned this before in the episode, but Mitch, the client, is all too happy to throw that back in Allison's face because apparently that is something you can find out when you're doing reference checks.
It's icky. And I've always found it icky that like within the corporate setting, you're not supposed to talk to each other about salary.
Yeah.
Like that's a weird big taboo. It's a fucked up taboo.
Yeah.
Insofar as someone's rent and expenses, I feel should be private. I can't even. But yes, let's get into my list of things that chilled me, things that confused me, things that I wanted to throw at.
Bring it on.
Let's talk about the whole realization that Hetty had effectively killed off everyone who knew of her.
Mm.
With Sam gone, Allie would not be able to convince others that she even existed. There was no paper trail, no prints, no nothing. It's ghostly and ghoulish, and it smacks of the creepiness of big city anonymity, but it also smacks of the Fight Club syndrome.
Yes.
Where I feel like if this movie came out today, there would be a giant question mark of imagine Hetty was all in her head.
Well, and I think that's, you know, I think Hetty is such an interesting character because she also exudes, again, when they talked about in that queer-sided episode about Hetty's dark sexuality. It's like, is Hetty a real person or is she just part of Allie's multitudes?
Yeah.
You know, is she the person who's actually really fucking pissed off at Sam and wants to go fuck that guy at the bar?
Yeah.
And want, like, all of these very normal, rational things to, like, don't kill your ex, please. maybe. But
if you do, don't trace it back to us.
Yeah.
Just no wipe your listening history.
We don't know. We don't want to know where the bodies are buried, but these are kind of rational, normal things. And Allie is so, fraught with anxiety about these feelings. And then you've got this kind of id in Hetty who is like acting on all of it.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I think it's a great question. I like part of me, maybe one day I will regret saying this, but like, maybe a remake?
Maybe a remake. Like, wasn't there talk of a TV show, a series?
Sure.
I choose to believe, and perhaps this is a little bit of Hetty apologism, but I choose to believe that Hetty has learned through trauma to live in liminal spaces.
Yes. Yeah.
And that she, like, as a self-protecting mechanism, it is safer to be someone else in these spaces than it is to be herself.
Yes.
And I think that is tragic. And I think that lends the film a lot of its clout. That is my preferred reading. But a couple of other lines that I found fascinating and I haven't quite landed on.
Okay. Okay.
At one point, Hetty says to Allie, "I've never met someone so scared of being a woman." I have been puzzling over that quote, and obviously these women have vastly differing experiences.
Can I say something
Please.
That might throw a fucking wrench?
Do it.
So what was your line read?
"I've never met someone so scared of being a woman."
So what I heard was, "I've never met someone so scared of being alone."
Is being a woman being alone?
If you are lacking a husband and a child, I think that's what this film says.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we don't have the film in front of us, so we can't verify this.
We can't.
But I like this unknowing.
Yeah.
Because both things could be said in the film.
Again, like these are just quotes that like drop like these bombs where you're like, whoa, talk more about that. But it doesn't. So
and
it just leaves us
and
thinking.
Because I heard, maybe it's just me, I heard alone because it's something that Andrew and I, you and I have talked a lot about personally, but you know, since my separation, divorce, living alone, it's like, oh, I'm actually happy now and I'm actually becoming more of myself than I ever was. And that's not for everyone. This is just for me. And I think you can be happy and totally yourself with someone else. I really, truly believe that, but for me. And so I think that this film, again, in my reading of it, like I heard alone possibly because it was like, oh, this film wants you to be scared
yeah.
of being alone.
Yeah.
When in fact, if you can manage it financially, and not a lot of people can truly, and it is a real privilege, but it is like transcendent.
That's a reading. That's a valid reading. I'm more inclined to like, when I think of Hetty's actions, when I think of the stuff that she actually does, she goes to the fetish bar.
Yeah.
She confronts, what's his nuts, Mitch?
Yeah.
To her, being a woman is fucking around.
Yeah.
Is being free. And you know, I think...
Being transgressive.
Depending on how you view what being a woman is, that quote is going to hit you in a different way. And that is delicious. And the other quotable quote,
mm-hmm.
"I'm not like your sister, Hetty. Not anymore. I'm like you now." Women can be a victim or a monster,
yeah.
and there is no in between. That is, if you have another reading, I'm all ears, but I was just kind of like, boof.
No, it reads a lot into, like, I think a lot of the discourse in recent years is, you know, trying to use the term of survivor
yeah.
more, which I think is great, and I really like that, and it's something I'm trying to use, and it's stuff like even in my work, like my day job life, where, you know, vernacular has been thrown around and I've corrected it a few times, and every time it's been like, oh yes, great call, yes, let's use survivor. Because it is like, once you survive something, once you go through something, you live beyond it.
Yeah.
It's part of your identity. It's part of your history. It may be a really looming figure or looming shadow in your life, and it may be something you can deal with.
Yeah.
There's a huge scope in between it, but...
There is, yeah. but not in this film.
No. And I think, like, your reading of it, that this film posits that, you know, after Hetty's death, Allison is kind of taking on this mantle.
I feel like I only really got that through the photograph.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
That I think is the exact intention of this film, is like, now this thing has kind of transferred over to Allison. Uh-huh. And now she's bearing this, and it's like, I hope she's okay, but maybe she'll be the next killer. Uh-huh. You know, there is this kind of anxiety of once you invite this chaotic force into your life, you are lost.
Yeah. And that chaotic force can be liberation.
Yeah.
Or it can be trauma. And it all results in the same, in this heteronormative, conservative reading.
I always think about when I talk to people, and people can have been very critical of us for being quote unquote anti-motherhood. And I hope no one thinks we are anti-motherhood or anti-having kids. We really aren't.
It's pro-choice.
We are pro-choice. Andrea and I, it's just not something that we want for ourselves. Kids are cool. They're great.
We have the privilege to choose that.
We have the privilege to choose.
Yeah.
But there is this, I have a lot of issues with the staggering amount of films, and it's like 99% of films that end or uphold a narrative where especially a woman can only be complete with a partner and a child. Mm-hmm. And it's like, there is so much cool shit to do out there. And you can do it with a husband or a child or a partner and a child or just a partner. Like, you can do it all.
Yeah.
I just hate that in these films that we watch for ourselves, that we take in, that we learn about our lives and that we see visions of our lives through. Like, they call it the dream factory for a reason. And when our dreams are limited to such a narrow scope, it's just so harmful.
Oh, yeah. It limits us when there's so much more to be experienced, and we don't have to be limited by our reproductive abilities. You know, that can be one avenue to living a fulfilling life, but there are other options. And yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I feel like all roads lead to this, but particularly with these narratives involving women who are problematized for trying to make it on their own.
Yeah. And we need more narratives.
Yeah.
And I think that's what is exciting to see in indie films. That's what's exciting to see in so many new things that are coming out. But it is important to revisit these kind of Hollywood classics.
These problematic Hollywood classics. Like, this is, it's a celebrated film. It's a film that anyone would recommend, but always with that caveat, by the way, it's really problematic. But, you know, problematic can be good in that it gets you questioning things. And this is exactly what we're all about.
Critical thinking is one of the coolest things you can do, in my opinion.
It's neato.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for joining us for our post-sabbatical back-to-school episode. Hopefully you have, you know, shaken off those cobwebs a little bit. We're opening the books. We're warming ourselves back up into some trickier fare on the horizon.
But we wanted to talk about new merch.
Oh, yes. Yes. Before we name the next episode,
we've got to talk about Class of 2023.
Oh, my God, you guys. This one is... I feel like I say this every year, but we've really outdone ourselves, Alex.
And by we mean the artist, Johnny, who goes by Last Johnny on the left on Instagram. We'll link his work below. And we will, of course, link our TeePublic storefront in the show notes. So please check it out. We'll be sharing all of the artwork on our social media, but he did such a cool fucking job. And check him out, follow him on Insta, and get, if you want, and if you can, grab a t-shirt, a magnet, a tote bag, whatever you want.
Pick it up, check it out, and know that it, as always, as this podcast is inspired by negative reviews who don't like girls talking about horror movies. Oh, you fuel us. You literally fuel us to the point of making merch and making money off it. So thank you for your one-star reviews. Thank you for your small-minded perspectives. We're literally cashing in on it.
When you tell us to shut up, we just yell louder.
And what are we going to yell louder about next month, Alexandra West?
I don't know if I can say it. If this feels like a you one.
I feel like this episode is a gift to me. Like after 10 years of doing the Faculty of Horror, Alex is like, finally getting down to my level, getting to talk about my really...
Because you're just so little.
I am small.
And I have to lean down.
I'm small and my tastes are so, you know, populist. And...
Oh, no! Your tastes are fucking long. I got new arm muscles fucking reading that thing.
What did she read? What does Andrea love more than anything? What was her gateway into the horror genre? What paperback book is on her shelf and falling apart from being read so many times? I wish there was an easier way to say it, but it's It. Stephen King's It.
We are talking, we'll talk about obviously the novel, which I have now read, but also the two new films, the first of which, It Part One, or Chapter One.
Yeah.
There we go. Is the highest grossing horror film of all time.
It puts the gross in grossing. There are two movies too many in this franchise, and we are going to talk about them all. And this, my God, you guys, this franchise is so, so near and dear to my heart, but there's a lot to talk about. And Alex is not only going to watch all the movies, but she fucking motherfucking read it.
I read it.
She read the whole thing.
All 1,200 pages of
it. It's not a small book.
I'm actually
kind of overcome. I'm deeply grateful.
Is this like how you feel like with me when you watch Vanderpump?
Kind of. Except I don't know that you're enjoying it as much as I'm enjoying Vanderpump.
No.
Yeah.
But I love that I can share this with you.
It's our October episode. It's Halloween.
We have to
always
do
Halloween with a big ass banger. And this is a fucking huge, huge one because there's a mini series. There's two overblown Hollywood movies and we're going to talk about them all. And that is going to be hitting your feeds next month.
Are we talking about the mini series? Because we already kind of talked about that.
I'm going to talk about it.
Okay. Cool. I'm learning about this in real time. We're going to talk about
it all. I made you watch it. Like, you don't have to watch it again.
Okay. Maybe Andrea will take that leg.
I didn't watch Single White Female 2.
Oh, yeah. I did watch Single White Female 2. Apologies. I didn't mention it. It's like straight to video and it is spectacular.
Okay.
It is pure trash. If you've got like $5 to rent it on Apple, I definitely recommend it. And then finally, a little plug for myself. If you are in the Toronto or the GTA area, I'm going to be doing my lecture on Brexit in the modern British horror film on October 17th at the Review Cinema. We'll link that in the show notes. So if you are in the area and you can come out that evening, please join us. I think it'll be fun. I've already forced Andrea to join us.
I'll be there. Alex will be there. I will have little treats if you show up in a Faculty of Horror t-shirt.
Oh, shit.
Because I'm lame like that.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much to our patrons who, fund this here show.
They fuel it all.
That's right. We will drop a link to the Patreon in our show notes, as well as everything we talked about today. And, until your roommate starts imitating you.
Office hours are closed.
Slay. to arise. We let the fire die down soon. All I always been here. Your favorite passion, your favorite game, your favorite mirror, your favorite slave. I'm hanging on your words, living on your breath. Feeling with your skin, will I always be here? I'm hanging on your words, living on your breath. Feeling with your skin, will I always be here? Hanging on your words, living on your breath. Feeling with your skin, will I always be here? Hanging on your words, living on your breath. Feeling with your skin.